Hello, and welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, Chief Investment Officer. Baskin Wealth Management is an independently owned investment management firm with over $2 billion in assets under management, providing customized wealth management solutions and services to families and foundations. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations that make sense about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast, and today I'm joined by a very special guest, Benjamin Klein. Benjamin has been at Baskin for how many years now?
Over 10 years October.
Oh my Lord, that makes me feel old. Benjamin is head of financial planning as well as a senior portfolio manager at Baskin, as well as an owner here. So he's got he's a triple threat. So we're going to talk today about, we're going to learn about what Benjamin does every day at Baskin, learn a little bit about financial planning and talk to Ben. And we're going to make this a regular segment because we want to answer your questions and we want to talk to you about our experience with financial planning and some of the tips and tricks we've learned for clients over the years. And so let's get into it. So Benjamin, why don't you introduce yourself to the audience and we'll go from there.
Sure. Thanks for having me. So as Barry said, or as I said, I guess, I've been here for over 10 years. I started in October of 2013, which was a long time ago. I joined Baskin. It was my second job out of school. I worked at a big mutual funds company that Barry, you worked at too.
Yeah, my first job also was
a couple of years before me.
CI Mutual Funds, as was yours, and then getting hired at Baskin. So it seems to be we've got something, some magic chemistry together as a result of that.
Yeah, as the more things change, the more they stay the same, as they say. So I worked there for about 18 months, kind of learned the ins and outs of the industry, learned, you know, how all the different accounts and taxation worked. I did learn a lot there, although I was I was ready to go by the time I was done. I started my CFA while I was at CI. I finished the first two levels. I came here, finished the third one, eventually got my charter. Before joining CI, I went to Queen's for my undergrad, did an economics degree. Wasn't 100% sure exactly what I wanted to do, but ended up in finance and investing and have enjoyed it. So I'm still here. I started at Baskin doing, of course, we were smaller back then, so there was a lot more overlap about what different people did. So I did some trading, some research, some work even in things like compliance and you know, investment strategy, those kinds of things. And that evolved into a little bit more client-facing over the years, eventually became a portfolio manager, a client-facing portfolio manager a couple of years later, first an associate portfolio manager, then a full portfolio manager, probably in 2018 or so. And as you said, became a partner 2.5 years ago, if I have my numbers right. So so I'll be here for a long time, just like you, I hope.
Got you locked up, man.
Yep, not going anywhere. Besides that, what are my hobbies? I play a lot of basketball, including with Ernest. Ernest and I were teammates for several seasons in a couple leagues around the city. And do a lot of competitive trivia. Two little kids.
That's all your time and work.
That's
so
it.
I mean, what else can you do?
I have a wife too. She's pretty great also.
Oh yeah, she's good. So financial planning, has that become your passion?
So it's financial planning is kind of an interesting concept. It's a little bit nebulous. It's the kind of thing that we always did to some degree. You know, clients would ask us, thinking about buying a house or thinking about changing jobs or thinking about retirement. Do I have enough? Or maybe even more specific questions, you know, along those lines. And we have a lot of experience between the portfolio managers. We must have, you know, 70, 80, 90, 100 years.
We don't have to count the years. That's not important. That's not important. Yeah.
Enough. We have enough experience. And so those are the kinds of things that we could always try to answer, but we've formalized it more in the last 3 or 4 years. So I did my CFP in 2018.
And, it's Certified Financial Planning
Certified Designation. Financial Planner. Okay. There are a couple in Canada. There's CFP. There's also PFP, Professional Financial Planner. It's not quite as concrete or as, you know, widespread as the CFA. Certainly it's Canada only, of course, although there is an equivalent in the States as well. But those are the primary financial planning designations in Canada.
Just going quickly off topic, Ben, but let's say you were having a meeting with a younger person who was in university or thinking of coming to the wealth management, would you say that getting the CFA is more important or getting the certified financial planning designation is more important in this day and age?
I think it depends what you want to do, but without knowing this hypothetical person, absolutely the CFP. Mm-hmm. You know, all anybody wants to talk about these days is AI and commoditization of investing in things like ETFs and other more passive investments. CFP, you know, is a lot more akin to almost like a skilled trade than working on picking investments, those kinds of and investment strategy, things like that. You know, every person is unique. One 30-year-old lawyer might be analogous to another 30-year-old lawyer, but they're not exactly the same. They have different wants, needs, objectives, risk tolerances, all those different qualities that make them unique. And you know, the human element of the CFP, it's much more human focused than CFA. CFA has a lot of institutional, I would say, bias towards institutional investing, and faceless is maybe the word to use. Whereas CFP is much more focused on the human element. And that's the kind of thing where I think a lot, certainly in our business, a lot of the value is added on the human side.
I totally agree with that, especially if AI replaces the stock picking part of our business. I hope it doesn't, because that's what I love to do. But definitely what our clients want is, how much money do I need to retire? What structures make the most sense? Even being at some point holding their hands, being somewhat of a psychologist with the markets when things are rough or things are not going well with that client's finances at a certain point in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think we've always said, certainly since I joined the firm, we wear a lot of hats.
Yeah.
We're the psychologist or psychiatrist. We wear the, of course, investment management side, financial planning. Sometimes even a friend, someone to someone's shoulder to cry on. I've had clients literally cry on my shoulder in meetings. And the financial planning side is it's much more holistic than purely focusing on the investment. And of course, the investment will never stop being important. Maybe the most important part, but the financial planning is I think something that's only going to be more important for younger people and for the industry going forward.
Yeah. So our firm has evolved from picking stocks and building out portfolios to including financial planning. And there'll be more evolution to come from that. But Benjamin is spearheading the financial planning department of Baskin, and he's the CFP, and we're working on doing financial plans for clients, as well as providing lots of different advice in terms of what types of structures, working with their accountants and lawyers. So if you could sum up financial planning, how would you sum it up? What do people need to know? And does everybody that eventually, you're hopefully going to retire, does everybody need to do a financial plan?
It's the kind of thing that it never hurts. The way I think about a financial plan, and maybe this is more appropriate for the audience of this particular podcast, it's kind of like a balance sheet, right? Like it's a point in time. It's not just necessarily a list of your net worth. I mean, anybody can do that if they put their minds to it. But it's getting a sense of where you are at this point in time and being able to refer back to that. Maybe next year, although people's situations don't often change that much year to year, but 2 years from now, 3 years from now, 5 years from now, and saying, particularly if you're in your 30s and 40s, or even if you're in your 50s and 60s, and you have hopefully decades left in your life and in your planning, you want to be able to refer back to that every few years and say, well, here's the trajectory I was on. What trajectory am I on now? Am I doing better than expected, worse than expected, the same as expected? And that to me is the value of having something on paper. That it's very easy for our brains to lose track of the kind of big picture as we're focused on the day to day, on a week to week, month to month, year to year basis. So it's the kind of thing where it's really valuable to have. Doesn't necessarily need to be updated every 6 minutes or 6 months?
Yeah.
Probably not. Of course, if there's a major change, you move, you have kids, you have a new job, that kind of thing, you lose your job, other kinds of circumstances like that. Absolutely. It should be updated and you want to make sure it's still valid. But it's the kind of thing that, you should have one. It's almost analogous to like a will, and the kind of thing that you should have one, and you should know that it's there, and you should know that it's still reflects what you hope to achieve or want to achieve. And you update it when you need to, and you make sure that things are still on track the way they were when you set it up. Mm-hmm.
So a financial plan is simply a living document that clients will work with, Baskin and their portfolio manager, to determine, to answer a lot of the questions. Do I have the right structures? Will I have enough to retire? When I retire and I'm taking out money, how long will it last for? What happens if the market goes down and stinks for 10 years? What happens if inflation goes up or interest rates go up? How should we change the asset allocation? These are things that need to be discussed, and as important or maybe more important than whether you own Google or Apple or Facebook.
Exactly. I think you alluded to this in that topic, which is, we don't know what investment returns are going to look like. Yep, we have a guess, and mm-hmm. we know what they've looked like historically, and we can, looking at trends and company returns and all those kinds of things, we can adjust those priors, as we like to say. But when it comes to planning, one of the biggest benefits, and I've said this to many of the clients I've worked with, of having a plan is you have this baseline, and not only looking at that year to year and seeing how things progress, you can also say, well, maybe I am realizing now I'm above where I need to be or below where I need to be. What happens if this changes? What happens if returns are half as good as we expect or twice as good as mm-hmm. we expect? What happens if, say, and this is a question I get all the time, what if I want to do something specific with my money? I'm 65-year-old, I'm retired or about to retire, yeah. and I want to give some money to my kids. That's the kind of thing. I'm sure you get this question all the time. And what does my portfolio look like if I do that? Mm-hmm. What does my portfolio look like if I do that and things aren't as good as we hope they are? Does that affect my ability to live the retirement, live the lifestyle that I want to in retirement? And when you have that baseline number from the plan that you did originally, it's very easy to change variables, look at different scenarios. And again, you can look at 100 different scenarios, still doesn't let you predict the future. It'd be nice if it did. But what it does is give you a better sense of what are the range of possible outcomes.
Yeah.
I think in financial planning and investing and just in the industry in general, it's very easy to, it's funny to say this, particularly with the software that I know that we and most people in the industry use, that you put in all the variables and it spits out a number. Mm-hmm. But the number is not necessarily valuable. It says that in 50 years, you're going to have $4.8 million, I hope. That would be nice. But that really, that's the most likely target is maybe the right word to use. But in reality, there's probably a range between 3 million and 20 million
yeah.
or whatever it is. And you need to know the likelihood and the range of confidence, I guess you could say, that you have between those various outcomes.
Yeah, most people just want to know, tell me the number and tell me I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
And so we can tell them the number, we can tell them to be okay, but doing a financial plan at least will make sure every year we're on the right path to getting to where we need to be. One of the things that I think differentiates us, a little talk in our book here, but versus banks where maybe the advisor is not a financial planner or isn't doing the financial plan and is outsourcing it to someone else at the bank, we get to know our clients, and generally our clients can talk to year to year to the same person who's the portfolio manager, who knows all the stocks and the investments in the portfolio, is also the same person who's done the financial plan. That's, I think, what a good selling point is. We know our clients hopefully really, really well, and we'll improve that going forward.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, to touch on a point we were just talking about before, I say, when we're doing these analyses, again, we don't know what things are going to look like 5 minutes from now, let alone 5 years or 30 years from now. So what I say is, we have this, again, jumping back to the point of the baseline, we do this analysis, and it's really, I call it like a Goldilocks analysis. Is the porridge too hot or too cold, or is it just about right? And, maybe it's really, really hot. Maybe you're way above where you need to be. You need to be giving more money to charity or something like that. Mm-hmm. Or maybe it's, too cold and you need to adjust your expectations or, make other changes that are going to get you where you need to go. Or it's about right. And you can't really get a lot more specific than that. As we know, particularly for plans that are projecting 20, 30, 50 years out, one percentage point change in some variable makes a huge difference. But and as I say, going back to that point of having the baseline to compare to, this is the most valuable part to me.
And hopefully we'll pick good investments and beat that baseline by a large margin. So Ben, we want to get, this is a good overview of financial planning and what we think about. We're going to get a little more specific. And our aim going forward with our podcast, doing Talking Financial Planning Together, is really to talk about our experiences with clients, give some specifics about things that, you know, different structures, how they work, what we're recommending, the types of things, mistakes we're seeing with clients. So I thought it'd be interesting just to talk about right now some of the mistakes we've seen with our clients over the years as they prepare for retirement, some of the things that they thought they would be okay, and then all of a sudden they weren't okay, things that they may have done wrong, even though, you know, the performance of the portfolios has been good. What have you seen that gets our clients into trouble?
I think it's going to sound a little bit funny, but I think paying too much attention to the market.
Yeah.
I'm sure this is something you've seen too. And I mean this in a very specific way. I mean, trying to time the market, trying to almost think you know better than the market, which I think we do a good job of not thinking that. You know, we know that nobody knows what the market's going to do tomorrow, or, you know, from now until 4 o'clock in the next 3.5 hours. We know that there are going to be ups, there are going to be downs in over time, or hopefully going to keep making money, and maybe we'll even make more money in the market if we do a good job. But we don't know. And over the long run, the best thing to do is put your money to work and put it to work in an appropriate way for your strategy. But I think the single biggest mistake that I've seen is really not understanding your own risk tolerance.
Mm-hmm.
We have a lot of clients that, and I'm sure there are a lot of people and investors around the world that have a lot of risk tolerance and the market's doing well.
Yes.
Not a lot of risk tolerance in the market's doing poorly. And no, I think on some level that's natural. We have a tendency to get caught up in the euphoria, in the excitement of everybody making money, or at least seeming like everybody's making money, and to get despondent and, you know, cynical and scared, honestly, when the market goes down. But that's the most dangerous thing you can do as an investor.
So if your plan says you need to earn 7% a year, and compound that for 20X years to get to a dollar amount where you can take out X amount, and that will be comfortable for you and your goals in retirement. And then all of a sudden the market stinks, or you have a few bad winners in your portfolio. You call up Benjamin, you call up Barry, you call up David, you call up Ernest, and you start telling us, sell this, sell that, I'm scared. Of course, that will do a lot of damage to your portfolio, because you're probably selling those stocks or making decisions at the wrong time. Of course, maybe we haven't done a good enough job of sussing out your risk tolerance, but if you need a certain percentage to earn it, you really have to stick with and trust that markets will deliver those returns over the long term.
Yeah, and we've all seen the research about, you know, if making these kinds of moves can way more than you might expect impact your long-term returns.
Cashing out your entire portfolio because you're worried about a specific event that's happening in 1 year that may not be repeatable.
I have I have more than one example of a client who, you know, against my advice, cashed out at a horrible time and missed literally double-digit moves in the market in a period of less than a week.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's that's the most difficult part is when things are the scariest is often the best time to do absolutely nothing. And that tends to be our advice.
I mean, the best example is COVID, year 2020, the start of COVID. The markets at some point in March 2020 were down 25-30%. You could have cashed out your portfolio and waited for the coast things to clear. And of course, you would have missed a gigantic run. Most of our clients ended up 2020 very positive. And it actually turned out to be a very, very good year. But, you know, you can do serious damage to your portfolio by getting nervous.
Yeah.
So that's helpful. But for me, Ben, I've seen clients get into trouble with their retirement planning when they get excited about leisure properties. When they're looking to, I want to buy a cottage. I want to buy a place in Florida. It's my dream. And then, of course, they overpay. There's things that happen to that leisure property, whether you need a new air conditioner, you need a new roof, you need a new porch, and then you're not working anymore, so there's no more income coming in. Now you need to fund your house, your condo, your primary residence. You also have to fund maintenance and expenses at your leisure property. Bad stuff can happen at any point in time. And then all of a sudden, the amount that you can take out of your portfolio to live off of, to feed yourself, to feed your family, is impacted by all the spending that you need for your house and your leisure property.
Anybody who owns certainly a house in Toronto, if they're lucky enough, mm-hmm. or a house or condo really anywhere, particularly in Canada, knows it's incredibly expensive to run a house.
Yeah,
you have, you know, if you live in a condo, you have condo fees, you have heating, you have utilities, you have cable, you have upkeep. And if you live in a house, you know, only more so. You've got landscaping, you've got, you know, all the other things that come with owning a house, and you have to replace things. And I think one thing that people don't realize is how much of these seemingly one-off expenses. I need a new furnace.
Yeah.
My fridge broke. I need to redo my driveway or my roof or these kind of things that seem one-off. But the reality is everything in your house has a lifespan,
yeah.
has to be replaced at some point. It's going to cost you a certain amount of money. And not incorporating that into their feeling about the cost of running a house. And when it comes to leisure properties, even more so.
Yeah.
Because you might have, you know, say you have a cottage in Muskoka that's not winterized. You need to have someone who's going to go up and check it.
Yeah.
You need to have someone who's going to, you know, clear the driveway when you want to go up there. You know, fix all the problems that you have from a cottage wherever it happens to be, or in Florida. It's enormously expensive. I think it's not obvious how much more expensive it is than maybe it seems off the bat. As an investment, that's a different discussion. But I have a lot of examples of clients who owned leisure properties. You might call them investment properties, but I wouldn't.
Yeah.
Leisure properties that, you know, are down significantly. But because even if real estate seems like a sure bet, which of course it isn't, in any one given spot, Florida, North Carolina, I don't know where people get leisure properties these days. You never know what the market's going to be like in that particular area.
It's regional.
Yeah.
Regional specific. So, and the thing is, in retirement, you need your assets to produce cash flow for you. There may be a point in time when the stock market is not doing well, or you have some dividend paying stocks that are not paying dividends, or you have fixed income, where the income is fixed at a very lousy rate, like the last few years up until recently. And then you have this leisure property that is requiring cash flow to upkeep. And then, of course, the market, you don't want to sell it because you're worried about capital gains, or you're worried about pricing at that point in time. So I really feel that for most of our clients, those that run into trouble in terms of their financial plan is when they buy those leisure properties. You can get a lot of enjoyment from renting for 1 or 2 months. And I know you don't get the appreciation, you don't have the tangibility of that asset, but from what I've seen, that's the biggest mistake for a lot of I won't name any clients, but for some clients who have gone knocked off their course. To rectify that, of course, they have to look to sell that leisure property, and they have no control over the timing or the price they can sell at when they need to sell. You never want to be in a position where you need to sell, Benjamin.
I think it's possible to make money on these kinds of investments if you time it luckily. I won't even say time it well, because so much of it comes down to luck. But I think for most people, the best case scenario is you break even.
Yeah.
And break even with, look, it's a lot of work to own a place. Mm-hmm. You know, I've said to clients who have asked my opinion, I've said, honestly, you couldn't pay me enough to do it. Even if I was guaranteed to make some money on it, I wouldn't do it, because it's just so much work. If I want to go somewhere, I'm going to rent. And look, if it's your dream and you can afford it, and you know you can afford it, enjoy it. But I think it's again, to come back to our original point, I think it's much more expensive and much more dangerous, might be the right term, to buy one of these places when you don't clearly have much more money than you need.
One of the issues that I've seen, of course, is one of the spouses is more interested in owning the cottage or the condo, and that's their baby. They do all the work for it. They take care of the property management, or they take care of the expenses. And then that one of the spouses unfortunately passes away or is not able to do it for health reasons. And then the other spouse is stuck. They had no interest in the first place. They have no acumen for that stuff. Those are other issues that go beyond financial planning, but things to consider when you're buying leisure property. We'll get into more of these lessons that we've learned over the years from financial planning, but I thought that was a good one to talk about. Some of the things are beyond our control, of course. health issues, our children requiring our support, falling on hard times, those things we can't control. So always when you build a financial plan, I assume you build in what's called a margin of safety.
Yeah. When we're doing this planning, I think, of course, it's up to the client what they want to look at and which scenarios they think are more likely and more important to look at and those kinds of things. But you know, I think the general stance is you look at things on a conservative level.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you think that you might need to be supporting somebody for the next 10 years, you know, maybe you just assume you're going to support them for the rest of their life or those kinds of things. You'd like to err on the side of conservatism. And if, you know, the numbers come in really close and it might be really tight, well, you can look at different scenarios and see what they might look like. But, you know, in general, for example, like life expectancy, I assume everybody's going to live to 100.
You assume everybody's going to live to 100.
And they might not.
In a plan.
In a plan.
Okay.
And they might not, but I mean, this is interesting. The last time I looked at the Canadian mortality tables, and yes, I'm the kind of person who actually opens the Canadian mortality tables that come up from the Government of Canada.
And are they updated in real time or a year delayed?
They're updated with every census. I think okay. They may be updated more often than that, but there's a big database that comes out with every census.
Okay, interesting.
And the last time I did it, you know, the numbers are pretty surprising. So if you take a 60-year-old couple, so two 60-year-old male and female couple.
Okay, we'll assume male and female for now. Just
yeah, which of course affects the life expectancy.
Yeah.
There's actually significantly more than 50% chance that one or both of them lives well into their 90s.
Okay.
And there's a significant chance, even with, you know, medicine, we would expect, you know, life expectancy to hopefully go up from here, that one of them lives to 100. Mm-hmm. So when you want to be conservative, and of course, you know, could go beyond that. I just had a grandfather die at 100 and my grandmother died at 96 and a half. Mm-hmm. We have some client, we have some centenarian clients. We have
absolutely
more than one, in fact.
Yeah.
You know, you don't want to plan to live to 95 or 90 or whatever the number you might use is, and turn out that you go longer than that.
Yeah.
So you know, I think when it comes to a couple, they're probably not going to both live to 100, but they might. And you want to err on the side of conservatism. And for most people, you know, if they die with more money than they thought they would, I think that's a success.
Yes.
So you want to plan on the conservative side, and you want to make sure that in terms of margin of safety, if the things that you were overly conservative on come out better than expected, fantastic.
Yeah.
There's your margin of safety kind of built in.
If someone, Benjamin, if someone retires at 60 and they live to 100, they could be retired as long as they were working, right? So you really have to make your money last. You may, depending on where interest rates are and where fixed income is, not getting too conservative too soon. I went to one of our clients who did turn 100 a few years ago, was sitting next to a gentleman who was a retired police officer, a high-ranking official. Anyways, he retired at age 55. He's now 98. But he's got the last laugh, so to speak, because his pension has lasted quite a long time. So he was really enjoying life and loved to talk stocks.
So great point. It's actually one thing that I wanted to talk about is I've kind of called it the hidden risk for investors. The obvious risk is right there that, you know, you pick bad stocks or the market goes down and you have less money than you thought. And mm-hmm. we think if you buy high quality businesses, of course they're going to go down in the short term, but they should recover and, you know, they make real products and they make real profits and there's obviously some value in there. And we think that, you know, those kinds of companies are very resilient. Mm-hmm. But the other side of the same coin is not taking enough risk. And it's very easy to get sucked into the worrying too much about the short-term risk and not worrying about, well, you know, look, if you make a ton of money and you're a great saver and you don't care about working until you're 75, you know, do whatever you want.
Remember that rule of thumb where you take your age and that's how much you should have in fixed income? I'm 75. I should have 75% of my portfolio in cash and GICs and CDs and bonds. Well, if they're paying 2% and you need to live off 5 or 6% a year, you're going to run out of money quickly, especially if you live to 100.
Exactly. And I think that going back to the point of, let's say you retire at 55 or even 65, if you're in reasonably good health, this is basically the second half of your life.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that you're going to retire and that's the end and the portfolio needs to support you. The portfolio is going to be around, we hope, mm-hmm. for 10, 20, 30 plus years. And the portfolio needs to be constructed in such a way that you have this long-term view. And maybe you do have more fixed income when, you know, the day you retire than you did 5 years earlier. But you need to have enough, whether it's, you know, whatever the asset class is, but, you know, for our clients, it needs to be more stock, because we fully expect that going forward, they're going to continue to do the heavy lifting of earning enough profit for clients to sustain their lifestyle in retirement.
Very good. So let's talk quickly, Ben. I was going to call you Ernest. so I used to be next to Ernest. Let's
no
talk,
offense taken.
No offense. Let's talk quickly about this new product that was launched in Canada called the First Time Home Buyers
first
or First Time Home
First Home Savings Account.
So FHSA.
FHSA.
Okay. Why don't you explain to everybody what it means and why we're pretty excited about it for our adult children?
So me too. Mm-hmm. I think it's a great product. Basically what it is just similarly to a TFSA, similarly to an RSP. It's an investment account you can open. You can put money into it. You get some tax benefits from it, and you can use the money inside there. Hopefully it's grown because you invested it in something. You can use that money to buy your first home. And if you're curious about how that's defined, it means you haven't owned a home, I think, in the last 4 years.
Okay.
Which is the same as the home buyer's plan, RSP. Not getting into those details. But
yeah.
Essentially, it needs to be your first home, or you haven't owned a home in a while. And the way it works is it's unique. It's has some similarities to the TFSA, has some similarities to the RSP. But basically, how it works is you put money in. You can put money in every year, up to $8,000 a year. And you get a tax deduction for the money that you put in, just like an RSP. Mm-hmm. Doesn't affect your contribution room, by the way.
For your RSP. Still max out your RSP, and you can put in a maximum amount that every year into the first time home safe. FHSA.
FHSA.
I'm going to screw that up every time.
You write it down on your legal pad.
Yeah, FHSA.
and so you get to put in $8,000 every year. You get a tax deduction, which is great, just like your RSP. And you can keep doing that every year up to a maximum of $40,000 contributed. Of course, it can grow to more than that. You can keep it for up to 15 years until you find a place. And if you withdraw it for what's called a qualifying home, meaning you qualify to buy this home, then you don't pay any tax on it.
Comes out tax-free. Grows tax-free. You get a tax deduction for every dollar that you put in, depending on your tax rate, of course. I mean, my son, Abe, who's 19 and in university, his income is next to nothing.
Yep.
So is there any reason for me to do that for him at age 19?
So the short answer is yes, but the longer answer is maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Because the answer is yes, because it grows tax-free inside there.
Yes.
If, let's say, he has a maxed out TFSA, if he does, lucky him, then there's room in the FHSA, which, unlike the RSP, does not depend on your income. If it doesn't have much income, doesn't have much RSP room. And it allows him to take the money out when he wants to without paying any taxes. So you get the secondary
the money that he didn't make, the money that my wife and I made that we gifted to him.
Well, that's nice.
Technically,
lucky him.
Yeah.
And so the benefit is the tax sheltering. You know, I often say to clients that there's this less obvious benefit of the RSP. Most people think about the deduction, which of course is a big part of it, but also inside the RSP and inside the FHSA, same idea, the money grows in a tax sheltered basis. So still better. What's the catch? There really isn't one. The only catch, I guess, is so when this was first announced, they were a little bit unclear about who's actually allowed to open one. And one of the things you can do is if you don't end up buying a house, you can actually move your FHSA into an RSP.
Okay.
Without worrying about contribution room.
Wonderful.
So why wouldn't everybody open an FHSA and do that? Going to get this free extra RSP room? Well, they thought of that. Sorry. You have to, when you cannot open the FHSA unless you qualify.
Yeah.
Meaning if you currently own a house or you owned a house last year, you cannot open an FHSA in the first place.
Yeah. So really for your adult children who are getting started and you want to kickstart some savings for them, get money out of your hands at a high tax rate, put it into their hands at a low, essentially there'll be no tax rate going forward, grows tax-free in their hands versus taxable in your hands. Sounds like a win-win-win.
It's really great. And I liken a lot to the TFSA, which is really, in a lot of cases, a no-downside proposition. If you have the excess cash to do this or you want to give it to your kids and you have the excess cash to give to them, it's really a fantastic product. I mean, the only other thing in terms of cash is it's not very big. You know, this was always the downside of the TFSA that, I mean, nowadays it's
the most you can put in is $40,000
correct
into the first time.
And one other kind of mini catch.
Yeah.
And this I actually didn't realize until all the details with the FHSA came out. The TFSA, just to kind of use it as a counterfactual, the TFSA, you get room as long as you were 18 or older in that year.
Yes.
You don't need to have a TFSA. You don't need to put money into it. You don't need to do anything. You just get the room.
Use it for whatever you want.
If you're now 25, you never used a TFSA, you can contribute whatever the number is, $30,000, $40,000 into there.
You can catch up on all the years that you missed.
That's not how the FHSA works. Mm-hmm. You need to have an open FHSA to get the room.
Okay, so if I open one in 2024, this year, I can only put in $8,000. Even though it was started last year, I can't put in $16,000. I can't catch up.
Correct.
What about if I open one in... I opened one in 2024. I didn't put any money in 2024, but now it's 2025. Can I catch up on 2024 and 2025?
Yes. So as long as you had the FHSA open, you get the room.
Yeah.
But you need to have it, and you really need to plan ahead. You know, let's say you're
so essentially get them open.
Yeah. So if you're eligible, you should have an FHSA. There's really no reason not to.
Ben, you're causing us a lot of work here.
It's a lot of work, yeah. And you know, for us, it's not. It's
40, happy 000, to do it for four, our clients.
$40,000 is, you know, is a lot of money.
Yeah.
But it, you know, it's never going to be an RSP. Nobody's ever going to have $1 million FHSA unless they do a really good job investing.
Unless they would have bought NVIDIA or something. Yeah.
You know, at any point in history, right?
Yeah. Okay. Very interesting. So I think the takeaways are, if you have adult children, get them open. I guess one question that I would have is, okay, I've only got $8,000 for my child. I'm helping them out. Should I put the money in my TFSA? Should I put the money in their TFSA? Should I do the first time home buyers? So many options. My mind's blown. What would you recommend then to a client?
Barry, you're opening a can of worms. So yeah. I'm going to jump on the last one first, which is the home buyers plan. So the home buyers plan, for anybody who doesn't know, means that just like the FHSA, same qualification criteria, you need to not own a home or at any time in the past few years. You can take what's essentially a tax-free loan from your RSP. Most people think of it as a withdrawal. It's not a withdrawal. It's a tax-free loan. You have to pay it back from your RSP. It used to be up to $25,000. They increased it to $35,000, I think, 2 years ago. And you can use that just like an FHSA to put towards purchasing a house. The downside, so you don't have to pay any tax on it. You don't have to pay any interest on it. Of course, relative to a mortgage makes it pretty attractive. The downside is you have to pay it back, and you actually have to pay it back in less time than you normally would a mortgage.
Yeah.
So when it, to me, it's typically valuable if you need to hit, say, it's the 20% mark, where if you have 20% down payment on a house in Canada, you don't need to buy mortgage insurance, which makes it way too much cheaper. But the benefit there is, you know, let's say that you have 30% of a down payment. It's not necessarily hugely valuable to you to actually use this plan in the first place, because it might not positively affect your cash flow at all. Because now every year you have to repay 1/15th, you have 15 years to pay it back of your home buyer's plan, loan. And so, you know, the benefit is not necessarily there. The FHSA, I think, is a much, much more attractive proposition.
Okay.
So what the best option to do is in this kind of situation where you have some excess cash, where do you want it to go? If you have the TFSA room, you know, TFSA is really a no-lose proposition. You can always, it's tax-free, never pay tax on it when the money comes out. You know, there's no immediate deduction. The FHSA might be more attractive.
Because you get tax deduction.
Let's say that you have an adult kid who makes a good income, but, you know, they have an expensive lifestyle, or, you know, even if they only make $100,000, which these days is not crazy for a new graduate or a young professional, that's a pretty significant deduction. That's close to 40% in Ontario.
Wow.
And that has a significant value to it. Ideally, you know, you can max out all these plans, but of course that requires a lot of cash flow to do. So it really depends on the income of the person in question, how much room you have in the various accounts. None of these are a bad way to go.
No, I don't think you can really lose.
It's really a no-lose proposition. One might be a little bit better than the other.
Well, so I think we've talked about a lot on this structure. So if you have questions, of course, we'd be happy to answer them and talk to you or your adult child about the best structure that makes sense for them. And it's confusing. We get it, but that's why we're here, and happy to do it. So This is just the first podcast that we're going to be doing on financial planning, and we have a lot more things we want to talk about in the future. We want to talk about RSPs. We get a lot of questions from clients. I'm 60. My accountant says don't do RSP anymore because I'm close to taking it out. We want to touch on that topic. Just so many things that we're going to get into over the next few months. So thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Benjamin, for your first appearance on the Long-Term Investing Podcast. This is the special financial planning edition. And Ernest and I will be back next week to talk about stocks. See you soon.
Thanks for having me.
This podcast is for informational purposes only. And any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.